Welcome to the December 11th meeting of the Pacifica National Board Strategic Planning Committee. Let me first take the roll call here. Let me start with Nancy Sword. Nancy, are you here?
I'm here.
Thank you. Beth Van Gutten.
Here.
Julie Hewitt.
Here.
Jim Sagerton.
Here.
Jim Dingman, I'm here. Egberto Willis, he's not here. Donna Grimes is not here. But we have quorum, so I'm going to proceed. Now I don't have minutes to submit, so I'm going to skip that. The meeting dates have been more or less established for the second Monday of the month. And I just had a agenda to approve quickly. The first was an update from me and Heather about national programming. The second was a little quick thing about Zoom technology. And the item after that was the state of the Pacifica archives. And then the item after that was a draft strategic plan, which I have, which I will start to send around to people. They can tear into it. And then just some brainstorming about turning around where we're at as in the foundation. We know it's lack of money, lack of money. And then we'll adjourn in 1 minute. Are there any oppositions or differences in the agenda or things that you want to add in there? All right, hearing none, the agenda is approved. I'm going to start quickly with an update on the national programming. Heather Gray is going to be contacting various PDs and GMs around the country. So we're going to have a meeting about all these issues that pertain to the must-carry resolution passed by the National Board several weeks ago concerning national programming on Gaza, Israel, Palestine. As I mentioned in the meeting of the board a week ago, my contribution will be something where I'm going to try to do something on the intellectual history of Edward Said, which I will produce as a generic item that can then be used anywhere throughout the country, including the affiliates. But that's where we're at on that. Does anybody have anything they want to say or add to that? Because the whole purpose of this, there's other people who wanted to come. I think Harvey Wasserman, if you're out there, I do apologize. I know you wanted to come and contribute to this. There's a lot of interest in doing national programming right now from different people around the country. But does anybody else want to add something to that at this point that they'd like to throw in the mix there? All right, hearing none, I assume that I can then move on to the next item. Now, the Zoom technology issue, we brought that up at the National Board meeting and the question of having dedicated Zoom accounts. And I think I tend to agree with those who felt like, you know, the money to be spent is insignificant, but, you know, whether stations will adopt that money or not is another question. And then the other issue raised with the Zoom technology is how you use it. Like if you get a big webinar kind of capability, which is more expensive, that can be used to market product throughout the system. But as I mentioned, I will make a report on that and the national board. Does anybody else want to add to that at all about the issue of Zoom technology? All right, go on.
This is Beth.
Go on, Beth.
I think it was I who raised the issue to begin with, because so many things have moved online post-pandemic, many meetings are being streamed on people's personal accounts, and that leaves Pacifica with beholden to individual account holders as to whether we get the recording, whether it's recorded at all, whether it's streamed, whether it's available, whether who gets in, who doesn't, whatever the muting policy is. All of that should not be left up to individual people. So I think we need a broader general policy. I don't know that every PNB or every LSB needs a separate account. I don't know. I I think we should assess the need. How many meetings does Pacifica actually have obligations to make public, and how much burden that would put on any one account, and whether we need, you know, one or three or five or whatever. But it just seems like, I know finances are tight, but this is the kind of thing that can seriously affect. I think it has been seriously affecting governance per se. And right. So I would like to do like an assessment with Otis, or the compliance officer on this, and the guy who knows the tech. And before we put anything forward, just guessing what the need is, before we put anything forward to the PNB, I would like to work with Otis to come up with a realistic assessment of what's necessary and what's possible. Thank you.
Anybody else have anything they want to add to that? All right, hearing none, I'll just throw one little segment in. One thing the Zoom technology can do is create greater community with the listeners. You know, various segments, day parts, in each day, a Monday day part, Tuesday day part, Wednesday day part, they can actually periodically hold meetings with their listeners through Zoom and, you know, whatever ways we can reinforce the interaction. But all good things, we can certainly work on that down the road. So let me move to the next item.
Jim, before you go on, may I say something?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I know that there are several Zoom accounts that are owned within Pacifica. Are not necessarily owned or controlled by the national office, but I think we should do an inventory of what Zoom accounts exist and how they could be utilized to serve the greater whole, much as we're doing with some other aspects of trying to leverage things for broader use.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean,
economies of scale.
Right. We could do two things. Survey how many people have Zoom accounts, the ones that are the middle level, to allow up to 100 people to be on the Zoom account. So people, I myself am using my own Zoom account that's in that category every once in a while for a meeting. But I hear Beth on all this. You know, there's ways we can straighten this all out. Anybody else want to say something about this before we move on to the next thing? All right, hearing nobody, I'm going to move on to the next thing. So let's talk about the state of the Pacifica Archives. Now, I invited Grace Aaron onto this. Grace, you have the floor. Describe to us your concerns about this.
Okay. Basically, way back in 2017, May of 2017, Brian DeShazer initiated a dialogue between Bill Crozier, who I believe was the IED at that time, and myself. I don't know what I was. Maybe I was the secretary but I don't know. But anyway, we spoke with Brian DeShazer and Josh Shepard. And Josh Shepard was, I don't know, he may still be the, let me read his credentials, director of the Radio Preservation Task Force of the Library of Congress and professor of media studies at Catholic University in Washington, D.C. So, Josh is also engaged with an organization of archivists from across the country and involving a number of different universities. And he's very, very concerned about the Pacifica Archives because it's considered extremely precious in archive circles and in preservation circles and historical circles. And the reason is that the archives go back to the 1940s, and they are unique. NPR didn't start out till after that. And the reason they're unique is that historians have, this is according to Josh, it may be in, I took notes of that meeting, luckily. So, and I can forward those notes to all of you. I sent it to a few of you earlier. Anyway, Josh said that they're considered really precious because we all have the top headlines historically, but the Pacifica Archives has the flavor of the time, the different things that happened that are not that weren't, never made the top headlines of the day in those days. So they're really extremely precious and important and considered important in historical and archive societies in the U.S. So Josh was concerned because our archives, according to him, had 5 years left at the maximum of the earliest and most precious recordings. He went over in detail about them. It's been since from 1917 to the present, I don't see any significant digitization of the archives. No, they've been in a climate-controlled situation for the most part, although some of the tapes are in storage, and that storage is not necessarily optimum. So that's the situation. They are degrading. Josh said at the time that they had a maximum of 5 years. That was at that time. So 2017, that would be 2022. Many of those precious recordings may be just dust at this time, unfortunately. But it's up to us who care about the archives and the history of Pacifica to do something about this. I would strongly suggest that we partner with an institution. At that time, Santa Barbara was interested in making an arrangement with us. There was some contention about that, but they do have the capacity, or they did have the capacity at that time, to begin the digitization process of the archive tapes. So I would suggest, even though there's been a few negative incidents that have occurred, I think we should push for a partnership with UC Santa Barbara and or any other large institution that has the capability and willingness to spend the money to digitize these archives. They have to be digitized in real time on old machines. There's no speeded up way to do this. And because the tapes are in really not good shape, it may take real expertise to be able to digitize them without having them crumble while they're being digitized. So I would like to say that I have heard no information that any major digitization is ongoing at the moment. The budget for the archives, I think, has dwindled to next to nothing. And back in 2005, 2010, in those periods, the prior director of the archives, who had been the director for 19 years, Brian DeShazer, was held in very excellent repute by people like Josh Shepard, who I'm sure helped Brian. I don't know specifically, but Brian got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars in funding to digitize sections of the archives. So, for instance, I think there was one large grant to digitize gay history of the 1970s or something like that. Then there was a grant for Black history in the civil rights movement, I believe. So significant amount of the archives selectively were digitized due to large grants from that Brian was able to acquire. But I have heard nothing in terms of partnering with anyone. I've heard of no significant digitization in the last any number of years. So I think we need to seriously consider, especially since KPFK building is being sold, and where are the archives going to be moved to or housed? They are very, very, very delicate. And what's going to happen with the tapes that are still in storage? And it's very troubling because these are really, really precious recordings. And who knows what's in them? I did, just to tell you, I did consider, could we sell the archives, part or all the archives? Not that I would suggest that. I was just wondering about that. And what Brian DeShazer told me is this. They're essentially worthless until they're digitized. The reason for that is the copyrights are questionable for every single tape. I mean, there might be a different provenance for every tape. Of course, we can use them, but whether we can sell them or not is questionable. So until they're digitized, there was an effort to see if they had any value in the condition that they're in, and it seems that they don't. Now, I'm just telling you from what I remember. Everything that I'm saying is from what I remember from that conference, and also the conference call with Josh Shepard and Brian DeShazer and Bill Crozier from 2017. But I believe we had one or two other conversations with that group, and also I had private conversations with Brian DeShazer and reports from Mark Torres as well later on. But I think we need to be concerned, and I think it's now the time to ramp up negotiations for housing the archives at a major institution that has the expertise to start digitizing on a more volume basis, and where we can still maintain ownership of the tapes and use of the tapes once they're digitized, but yet have some benefit go to the institution that digitizes them. Okay, that's all I have to say.
All right, very important. Does anybody have a comment on this? Just raise your hands. I'll go down the order. Anybody want to say something about this?
Well, James.
Yeah, go on, Jim.
Yeah, was the executive director invited to this meeting? Because
he was.
I know she's in touch with one or more universities. I know that some decisions are being contemplated about what to do. I myself am concerned that there may be an attitude that the archives are to be sloughed off and they're become a burden. I guess the essential thing is, again, to get some kind of an inventory to see what we have. I will say that I was shocked to find out that this one separate location where they're being held, the climate control broke down, and they've been without climate control for an extended period of time, some number of tapes, I'm not sure. And there was a report that upon entering the building where they were, that they were in a disorganized state. Things were scattered about. Things weren't shelved. Things weren't up off the floor in some cases. So I'm very concerned about the state of the archives, and I'm shocked that we didn't know more about it sooner. I'm glad we do now, but we need an inventory. We need to find out what we've got, what state it's in, and we really, it's time to stop talking about it and actually do something. So I'm glad we're talking about it here, but I wish the executive director was here so she could give us an update on what she's been doing. She does give us periodic updates on the PNB, but we could use some more detail, I think, and more progress, reports on progress. Thank you.
All right, maybe one of us could call her up. Go on, Beth.
Thank you. I just, I agree with Grace. Grace is right. This should have been dealt with long ago. Honestly, I think a lot of it should have been handled before I ever even cycled on to the PNB. It's languished. I think at this point, Pacifica has probably more than proven its inability to come to terms with the responsibility for maintaining these tapes in an archival state. And therefore, I think our next responsibility then is to make arrangements with some institution that has a greater capability than our own And yes, we should retain rights of ownership and monetization, but custody, I'm more than prepared to turn over to someone who's actually set up to do this rather than let them deteriorate any further under Pacifica's control. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Julie, do you have want to jump in on this? Or does Nancy?
Not really.
All right. It's an issue that we just simply lack the resources, frankly. I mean, it's when you consider all the different demands on everything, it's one issue, which is very important. But, you know, if I recall, the amount of money to be allocated that would be needed to digitize is in the millions. If someone can correct me if that estimate is inaccurate, but I understand we're talking about at least $1 million and $7 million to do it. I think I was talking with Stephanie about this a couple of months ago, and there was a outfit somewhere in the East Coast that was offered to do it, and it was a large amount of money that obviously does not exist in the foundation given its state right now. So, this is something that has to be paid attention to as part of the whole process.
The last time I was on the board a couple of years ago, I thought that there was an effort to, I thought we were getting some grant money to start digitizing them. Does anybody know if that's been, if that was done and completed? Or is it ongoing?
I don't know. Does anybody? Stephanie would know. Grace, do you know anything about that? Was money actually allocated to digitize?
I know nothing about anything. Even if there was some grant funding, we have to look further than that. You know, the project of digitizing the archives is a monumental task. And I can't even imagine that any amount of grant funding would cover the work that needs to be done. And who knows what's, I mean, I know that over the years, a number of very precious things are found in the archives, including Martin Luther King speech that nobody else had, that is the property now, basically, of Pacifica. And then we found, I believe the archives found a very old recording of Bob Dylan when he was interviewed by WBAI many years ago. So there's incredible stuff, but it's not like it's labeled or anything. It's not cataloged or labeled. Who knows what's in those old recordings? So anyway, that's it. I can tell you a little about the difficulty with UC Santa Barbara if you want.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, what happened a number of years ago is we stopped paying the rent on a storage facility that had a significant number. Maybe you know about this already. But anyway, a storage facility that housed Pacifica archive materials. The rent was not paid. Eventually, the contents were auctioned. Somebody who in the KPFA area who cared about Pacifica bought the tapes, took possession of them, and sold them to UC Santa Barbara. And when finally somebody in Pacifica woke up, they demanded those tapes back from UC Santa Barbara. And UC Santa Barbara said, no, we want to keep the tapes. You defaulted. You're not whatever. So that's the bad blood that happened between UC Santa Barbara and Pacifica. I'm not going to take a position on who's right or wrong, but the point is that to my knowledge, there were only two universities willing and capable of doing the digitization and taking custody of the archives. And one was, I believe that Josh Shepard and Brian DeShazer felt that UC Santa Barbara was the most equipped and the best bet. Also, it's in California, it's local. I think there was another institution, possibly in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure exactly where. But I think it's really, really important that we figure out a way to create an agreement with an institution that is beneficial to the institution and to Pacifica, and so, and to mankind, because this is not a Pacifica issue. This is history. This is precious material that's going to be lost if we don't do something about it.
All right. Very true, Grace. Go on, Beth.
Thank you. Given that the Pacifica location here in LA that has housed the archive for so long is part of this upheaval, logistical upheaval, and that given that we're talking about such fragile artifacts, these tapes should not be moved any more often than necessary. If we're going to make other arrangements, this is a strategic time to make other arrangements that could mean then that we only have to move them once if we're timely about making arrangements, rather than move them from wherever they are now into storage and risk not being able to cover the cost of the storage and then move them yet again another time. Every time they're moved, they're put at risk. So I think we should be prompt about it's not as if we haven't had the chance to look at all our options. We've known what our options are for years. We need to direct our executive director to bring us the most favorable options out there so the PND can make a strategic decision on this as soon as possible so that they only have to be moved once. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Beth. I see Chris Corey has joined us. Chris, do you want to jump in on this or you have anything to add to this discussion?
As I'm entering the discussion late, I'm kind of gathering what it is about. I do have one question, if I may. My understanding is that a good number is this regarding moving the archives from LA to some more, secure, I guess would be a way of putting it, location. Is that what this is about?
This is about talking about the problem in general, and I guess that's one option among many.
Okay. What percentage of the archives? I have been told at various times that a large percentage of the archives aren't even located in LA anymore. Is that not true? And if it is true, what percentage of archives remain in LA at this time at the KPFK site?
Do you know that, Grace?
No, I have no idea. My information is quite dated. I don't have an update. All I know, I have not heard of any significant digitization in the last few years. Chris, the concern I have and we have here is not necessarily the location of the archives. It's the digitization of the archives. According to Josh Shepard, from the Library of Congress, that's from a discussion, a conference call I had with him and Bill Crozier and Brian DeShazer, the then director of the archives. We talked about the fragility of the archives and the fact that the older tapes, which are very, very, very precious, are degrading. And they may have been completely degraded. So it's really important to save this precious historical archive. And the way to do that is to start the digitization process. We don't have the resources, nor is there any even fantasy concept that we're going to be able to find the resources to digitize them ourselves in-house. So I would strongly suggest that we start the process of negotiating with an institution that's willing and able to take custody of the archives or part of the archives and start the digitization process, especially of the most fragile, oldest recordings that we have. I don't think it matters so much what we have. I think we need to first make some sort of agreement and then have that agreement be customized as the process moves forward. But the digitization is what needs to be done. We don't have the capacity to do the digitization in-house. Even when Brian DeShazer, who was the past director of Pacifica Archives, was able to get hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants, that was still only able to digitize certain portions of the selected portions of the archives, really small portions. Digitization is a tedious, extremely slow process. It has, from what I can tell from these discussions, it has to be done in real time on old machines. There's no quick way to digitize them. And it has to be done by archival experts to some extent, because the older tapes, which are the most precious, of course, are probably extremely fragile. So it's going to take experts to figure out if they can be digitized and how to safely digitize them. But the point is here, not housing them, it's to digitize them, figure out a way to make an agreement with some institution, or that would be my suggestion, so that we can save this enormously valuable resource.
All right. Any more comments on this issue? Yeah, go on, Chris.
Yeah, Jim, I want to say something.
Well, let Chris Jim. Just, yeah, go on. Go on, Jim.
No, let Chris go. Let Chris go if he's ready.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Now that I know what the topic is, so this was under discussion. I know it was. And I heard what you said earlier, that we were in conversation with one of the universities, and I remember that as well. And I can't remember how that all played out. If you could refresh my memory, and if you've already said so and you don't want to repeat it, that's fine. But if you could briefly just remind me of who we approached and how far we got. Oh, and there is still one other question too, and that's what percentage of the archives are digitized at this juncture? Thanks.
Yeah, do you know that, Grace?
I don't. I would imagine it's a very small portion, but that's a question for Mark Torres. I don't have an answer to that question. The discussions were, Brian DeShazer, as I said, he had been the director of the Pacifica Archives for 19 years. And, he was working with Josh Shepard, who is, let me tell you what his bona fides are. He's the director, or was the director, of the Radio Preservation Task Force of the Library of Congress. And, he was, many archivists were concerned and historians were concerned at top levels of, American historical societies and archive societies. And they consider the Pacifica Archives extremely, extremely valuble historically. At any rate, discussions were ongoing between Brian and Josh Shepard. And we also, on the conference call was somebody from UC Santa Barbara. If it wasn't, I took notes on significant notes on one conference call, but we had several conference calls. And the representative from UC Santa Barbara was on at least one or two of those calls. So we were negotiating with UC Santa Barbara at that time to take custody of the archives so that the digitization process could begin. They fell flat. Brian DeShazer left Pacifica. He was held in really, really high esteem by Josh Shepard and others. And as from what I can tell, no, Brian would get large grants on a regular basis. And that's how those grants were used to hire experts to help with the digitization process. It was not done, most of it was not done in-house, or it was done under, maybe it was done in-house, but it was under the tutelage of of some archival experts through who were paid through the grant funding. Any rate, so there were discussions with UC Santa Barbara. At that time, they had the willingness and capacity to do the digitization. There was maybe one other university that could have been possible, but that was in another part of the country. As I say, the most precious portion of the archives are the tapes from the 40s and early 50s, because that's the only audio. There was no TV back then, and NPR didn't even start until I think the late 50s or early 60s. So we are it. There are no audio archives outside of Pacifica for that period of time, which is what makes them so important in historical circles. So it just went nowhere. I believe that Mark Torres talked about the Shoah Foundation being interested. That's with USC, but nothing came of that to my knowledge. And I don't think any significant, the staff, budget for the archives has shrunk. I think that probably it would be my guess. I have no current data. I suggest that you get current data from Mark Torres and from Stephanie. But, from what I can kind of, I'm assuming, that there has been, virtually no significant digitization since 2017.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And that was kind of the last time I inquired about this. So thanks. Okay. Yeah, that's that's very distressing. Thank you.
All right, go on, Jim.
All right, back in. Yeah, I want to ask Julie a question. Julie, there have been some conversations with Stephanie about other universities, and I don't recall if that's supposed to be confidential. There's the other universities that we've been talking to. Is that confidential as far as you know?
So I can't remember the details off the top of my head, and I would have to go back and look at notes, and, you know, I didn't realize that's, this is what we'd be talking about this evening so that I could prepare. So I can't actually answer your question either. Sorry.
So I won't name universities, but there are a couple of universities that I know that we're in conversation with now. My own conversations with Brian DeShazer, I don't want to, again, go into too much detail, but he was very unhappy at the time. I believe he was very upset that Pacifica had not followed through on some of the major grants that he was getting for this purpose, and that had to do with why he moved on, at least in what he was relating to me. So this kind of goes with Beth's idea that, you know, Pacifica is kind of has dropped the ball probably more than once in this area. And, the pace of digitization, my understanding is it's right now we're outsourcing whatever digitization is going on, and it's costing us like $240 a pop to digitize a tape. Supposedly some of the universities who are more set up for it could do it at a much reduced cost. The question of copyright has constantly come up as a difficulty in utilizing them when we were thinking about using some of our tapes as for use in non-fungible, what are they called, NFTs. Non-fungible tokens when they were popular. It's the Bitcoin derivative. We found out that, you know, we weren't clear on the copyright. Some tapes, the programmers retain some copyright. It could be their estates for people who are no longer with us. The Martin Luther King example, their family had, the King family, keeps a tight rein on those things. And apparently we have the tape, but we don't necessarily have a clear copyright to it. We don't have any copyright to it, is my understanding. So most of the tapes have a clouded copyright history. So that's just an additional difficulty in figuring out what to do. But yeah, at the rate that we're going, you know, it'll be like 10,000 years before we digitize these tapes and preserve them. And at some point, I mean, I'm not ready to give up custody or, you know, give up rights or anything of that sort. But if these really are, and I have no doubt they are, I mean, I don't think they all are, but no doubt many of them are significant historical documents, we have to decide, are we just going to cling on to them until they disappear? You know, that magnetic tape, the dust, it turns into dust after a while. And, you know, are we just going to contemplate what to do while they disappear? Or are we going to get serious about preserving them, if not for Pacifica's benefit, as has been said, for the benefit of history? So, yeah, we really need to do something. And I know that Stephanie is thinking about it and working on it. And it does come up in our meetings. I do wish she was here. Has anybody been able to reach out to her to see if she could join us for a moment?
I haven't had time.
All right. I'll let somebody else speak and I'll be there.
Go on, Greg.
Can I?
Go on, Greg.
Okay, two things. I think we shouldn't discuss personnel matters over the in a public meeting about Brian DeShazer, but that was not really why Brian is no longer with Pacifica. But I don't want to go into details about that. But I would like to read you. I am a fast typist, and I take pretty much stenographic notes. So I'd like to read you some things that Josh Shepard said in this meeting in May of 2017. He said, these materials are degrading. They will suddenly disappear. The danger is very real. Number one, deferments or mistreatment is of great concern. Number two, Pacifica is the only institution of the status that doesn't have a university, of this status that doesn't have a university partnership. This can be very easily arranged. Santa Barbara is one of two of the best radio scholars in the world. Unusual opportunity. He felt that UC Santa Barbara is the best institution. And he said that the task force, the preservation task force, can't receive money. They could only help Pacifica get money for preservation. No money goes to anyone in the task force. And he said 2 years ago, when this is 2 years before 2017, so it'd be 2015, when Christopher Sterling, chair of the National Recording Preservation Board of the Library of Congress, dean at George Washington University, said 2 years ago, the assessment of analog tapes, there really is a finite time, which is 10 years. That was 2 years ago. If we don't get it done soon, the tapes will be too degraded to warrant preservation. We did see a small percentage of degraded tapes in the last two preservation projects. Bleed through was one problem. Even as of 2 years ago, there was some degradation. 10 years is actually the maximum. Some tapes are probably already lost. You wait 10 years and you lose everything. Universities have to step in on this. If you do it before the 10 years, you might save most of it. So this was 2017. Who knows if there's anything left? We may be, this may be an exercise in futility, but nonetheless, I'm bringing this up. There may be a chance to preserve some of the archives at least, but let's be honest. We can't do it in-house. It's not possible. We have to partner with some institution that's capable of doing it.
All right. And obviously, this is one problem among many that have confronted everybody for the past 10 years. And unfortunately, it's been allowed to slip by. But we know, of course, the issue of basic survival has been uppermost in most people's minds. So this unfortunately goes to the back burner. All right. So I didn't necessarily want to come out with a motion on this issue. Does anybody, I mean, we could offer a motion to the PNB that we set up a task force to deal with this issue. The new PNB set up a task force to try to work on solving this problem of the archives. Is that something that someone would feel comfortable wording? Anybody here? Jim? Well, I offer that as an idea that we just simply, we set up, we offer to the board, the task force be formed to deal with this issue about the archives and come up with concrete recommendations that can aid the ED and others in how to effectively deal with SCON, Beth.
Thank you. I would like us to request a report, a status report from the executive director on the state of the archives, what she's done to this point, what the options are, what the current moving plans are. I have a lot of reservations about setting up a new separate task force. This is the end of, first it's the holiday season, then it's the end of the year. There's about to be like 3 months or so of churn on all the boards and committees. And so seeing, and this meet the move, whatever the move is, has to be completed by the end of January. And so there are task forces, moving task forces that could help implement and just discuss what the options are just logistically at the operational level. Mo will be out there within not too much longer. He'll be on site. So I'm more inclined to request a report from the executive director. Maybe we can, I did, that would mean that the motion wouldn't come from the committee, but maybe we should give some thought to what would be the most appropriate motion for the PNB at that point. I'm not a fan of drafting motions on the fly in committee. That's just not the place to do wordsmithing. Not that I'm not willing to put work into it, but not in this context. It's not the way you get the best thinking from people. But we do need to know what Stephanie knows and has done and her perspective on it, and if she has a recommendation, and if she knows for certain that certain things are not options, we need to know that too. We just don't have enough information.
No, she's not here. I know that I've talked to her.
Just FYI, I just texted her and called her, and I didn't get her, but I left her the link to the meeting here.
All right. I have talked to her about this in the past. For the record, I was a manager of one of the best moving companies in New York City for 12 years, so I know the business. As I understand it, there are storage facilities. I think there are two or three. Julie may have a better grasp of this than me, but there are several storage facilities where the bulk of the tapes are. And if I recall, we had a big debate. Jim will recall this. We were arguing about one wasn't refrigerated. All this other stuff. So that gets into the deterioration of the tapes issue. And I have no idea what the tapes are like in the facility at KPFK. However, these are things that when you look at the overall cost of moving things out, they're part of it, but they're not, you know, decisive. I mean, you can put all this stuff into storage facilities. The question is, what to do with it and how you're going to exploit it? And that's what we're raising. You know, as a sidebar issue that, you know, it's time to now exploit this stuff. It's now time to really think about, you know, taking it, digitizing it. And yes, I know about the stuff with Brian. We can't talk about that on the air here. But it's no longer, now something has to be done with it. And for all the reasons that Grace has, outlined, a friend of mine just approached Stephanie to, do a book on, basically directors, film directors interviewed by people at Pacifica over the past 60 to 70 years. And remember that we had the famous Pauline Kael was out there at KPFA for a long time before she came to the New Yorker. So there's a lot of things that one can find. That's why we have to get done and work on it. So Again, if people aren't in the mood to do a motion, fine, no problem. You know, we can move on to the next topic. Does anybody else have anything they want to say about this at this point?
Yeah, Jim, one more thing.
Go on, Jim.
I wanted to add, you know, not to leave the impression that nothing is being done or contemplated here currently. I know that it's been announced publicly that one of the aspects of the arrangement to sell the KPFK building and then return a rent-free arrangement has to do with getting assistance from the buyers with digitizing the tapes. They were specifically interested in working with an historical studio, and they are interested in helping with that as a project. I don't know what the details may be or might be, but that's another thing that's in the works.
All right. Any other comments about this at this point in time? All right. Hearing none, I'm going to move to the next item. I just sent you that draft strategic plan. I sent it out to the universe. I have not, it's purely a rough draft. It's, not to be defined as anything, fixed in solid time. It can be simply used as a jump off point, rip it apart one way or the other. But I think it's important for us to, have a viable strategic plan that everybody on the board can agree on, moving forward. And, you know, there's another strategic plan as the board, this board is aware of. I'm going to get the authorization to send that out. All this has to be revised and updated, but it's important to have, I think, a rough idea of where we're going and, something that can sort of keep us down, with a positive vision moving forward. Even though I'm well aware, we're all well aware of the fiscal problems that we're facing that are extremely difficult to solve as a problem. But that's the whole purpose of that. And, people can read it. They can tear it up, you know, but, we just have to start to have that process underway. Any comments or questions? All right. Hearing none, let me move to the next item, which is I'm sort of curious to hear, Julie, if you could perhaps give a report about what we can talk about openly in open session here about the status of the foundation, maybe Jim as the treasurer of the basically in charge of the finance committee. If you guys could sort of give our audience a synopsis of where we're at and and then we can brainstorm for a few minutes before we go, what ideas we have to change the situation around. Jim, do you want to start on that? Mr. Sagerton?
Yeah, I'm not clear on what your question is.
I'm just sort of curious. What are some positive trends out there in Pacifica land that we should note tonight about things that are moving in positive ways all these different stations are trying to deal with these problems. What do people think? What measures are being adopted that we could perhaps talk about and learn from?
I'm still not clear on what you want here. I mean, what are we trying to do to improve the situation?
Yeah, correct.
I think it's very slow going. We need to raise our audience levels so that we have more people, a larger pool of people who will consider becoming members. We have to be putting out programming that they're interested in listening to and then donating for. We need to expand our digital presence. You know, radio is still a large audience, but it's not where the action is, so to speak, in the kind of intellectual broadcasting that we and cultural broadcasting that we do. We need to move into podcasting in a serious way. We are streaming. We do have digital presence, but we need to bolster it. We need to become a brand. We need to develop some national programming. All of this is very, very difficult because we're on an extremely limited budget. We're managing our demise rather than expanding into a brave new world, so to speak. So we know what we need to do. You know, how can we get the grants and the wherewithal to do it? I guess, unfortunately, selling assets has been where we've been going in recent years. Hopefully, we can get the audits done when we have a successful completion of the sale of the KPFK building. That can put us in a position to go out and seek more funding. Hopefully, we did make an attempt to get CPB grants restored. We didn't make it this time. Maybe we can make it the next time. We just have to keep plugging away. We need to work on development. We need people working on getting grants of other kinds. I think we need to do an appeal to our historic membership list. We need to make an appeal by email, I guess, primarily, but, you know, also by letter. We need to be doing a national campaign, not just within the Pacifica network, but outside of the Pacifica network, appealing to the broad progressive left and cultural communities that we've historically been associated with, and be honest about our situation, lay it out to people, have some ideas about where we want to go in terms of expanding our footprint and expanding our platforms, and make a direct appeal. We need funds to do the kind of development we need to carry forward. And that should be our focus.
All right. Anybody else want to chime in what sort of ideas they have, what positive things they see going on, or what we should do? One thing I've seen in terms of actually doing work is when you're working in a situation where stations don't have much resources, such as in New York, you sort of see the impact of not having a promotional capability, one that is pretty robust using social media beyond what we have, and basically reaching out and advertising things that we do to people so they can see, creating a splash, if you will. But that's something I've seen concretely in what I've been doing since the 7th of October on air. And I critique myself because, you know, I've been doing as good a job as I can, but has it translated into meaningful revenue? No. So I would critique myself on that one. You know, it's just an interesting question. How do you take programming? Is the programming good? Is it bad? And make it and monetize it, you know, because it's easy for us to criticize. And that document I just sent will get into great detail on criticizing everybody throughout the system, including the stations that, quote, are doing better than others are. But, you know, that's an interesting problem. How do we do that? Does anybody have any thoughts that they want to share before we shut out the meeting tonight?
Jim, I have one more thought, actually two.
Yeah.
One is it's, again, laying out some of the difficulties. It's very difficult. We are in millions of dollars worth of debt. Some of it long-term, a lot of it not. About $4 million in immediately due debt, which is, we're trying to renegotiate some of it with the big loan. That's critical, and it makes it hard to move forward on, you know, development projects. But one of the easiest things that you can do, it's not necessarily just easy, but is move things to YouTube. YouTube is the largest publisher in the world. It doesn't take much. This is how Amy Goodman kind of got started. She had her microphone in her studio, and she set up a camera, and she went on YouTube and other platforms, I presume, and immediately, you know, increased her presence. And we've seen a couple of examples where Pacifica programming gets onto YouTube and all of a sudden it explodes, the number of people paying attention. So that's something we could work on immediately and maybe get some traction.
Yeah, I should add with Amy, our outgoing chair in New York, Dee Dee Halleck, was partially responsible for helping Amy move into a TV format. She started to do that during the 2000 election. And I worked down the street from Amy in a outfit that was working with Free Speech TV when she was down at DCTV in Lower Manhattan, which is, you know, for those who don't know New York, it's close to City Hall. So she was working and developing a multi-platformed radio show, TV show, multimedia show, except, of course, she had decent resources. Her budget is, I believe, someone can correct me if I'm wrong. I heard somebody say recently she had an $18 million a year budget, but at that point in time, it was anywhere from 8 to 9 to 10 million. It was essentially equal to the entire revenue of Pacifica. So hence, she can hire people. She can have competent people working for her, et cetera. It's a, and you know, and you see it in the work she does. I mean, she gets what, at least 2 million people listening to her a day when she goes on all those different platforms. But that's the kind of thing, you're right, Jim. That's, it just is it that we need to do that. We need to, you know, maybe I would think maybe take the best of the day part shows, the morning shows and the afternoon shows in a Pacific radio station that do well. And transform them like that into a multifaceted, multimedia thing. I noticed, for example, when I interviewed Gerald Horn, somebody took Gerald Horn, when I had him with a Palestinian scholar a couple of weeks ago, and they took it and turned it into a YouTube video. It had 7,000 views. And, you know, that was just, I have no idea who did it. They are obviously someone who loves Gerald Horn. They took it and transferred it and made it into a YouTube video with 7,000 views. Now that's something we could do. We could do that. And, you know, again, we lack the people. We lack the resources to do that, but that is something we could do down the road. Anyway, anybody else have something they want to add to this? Cause we know how tough it is to talk about this stuff and I'm well aware of it. Anybody else have any comments that they want to make? Chris, Beth, Nancy, Julie, Grace. All right. On that note, I move to adjourn the meeting. I want to thank Grace for coming to help us talk about this issue of the archives. And I move to adjourn.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Thanks, Chris, for coming. Okay. Thanks, guys. Take it easy.
Good night, all.
Night.